Welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. It is our intention to continue offering these audio recordings free of charge. However, if you would like to donate to support our cause and keeping our facility open in Nashville, you can do so via the Venmo app by sending a donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can find us online at our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, and click the Donate tab. Ajahn Chah, Thai Forest Master, Meditation Teacher, beloved individual in Thailand, had over 1 million people at his funeral, a part of our Buddhist lineage. This is what he had to say. He said, "People have suffered in one place, so they go somewhere else. When they've suffered there, they run off again. They think they're running away from suffering, but they're not. It goes with them. They carry suffering around without knowing it. If we don't know suffering, then we can't know the cause of suffering. If we don't know the cause of suffering, then we can't know its release." He had such a concise way to teach the Buddha's teachings. If we don't know suffering, then we can't know the cause of suffering. If we don't know the cause of suffering, then we can't know its release. Sometimes the Buddha's quoted as saying that he only taught really one thing. It's really kind of two things, but he said the cause of suffering and the end of suffering. Suffering and its end. In the Buddhist framework, we make a distinction between pain and suffering. Right, this is the Buddha's teaching on the second arrow, that when we experience pain in life, it's often compounded by a second arrow, a mental suffering that accompanies it. A mental story, a mental attitude. The Buddha says in one of his teachings on the second arrow that when touched with a feeling of pain, the person without mindfulness present will sorrow, grieve, and lament, beat his breast, and become distraught. So in this way, this person will feel two pains, both physical and mental. Just as if they were to shoot this man with an arrow and right afterward were to shoot him with another one, so he would feel two arrows. In the same way, when touched with a feeling of pain, the person without mindfulness present will sorrow, grieve, and lament, beat his breast, and become distraught. So in this way, he feels two pains, two arrows, one physical, one mental. So life inevitably contains pain. Last week, if you were here, we talked about the five reflections, which is a Buddhist practice on helping us to live more purposefully and with more importance in this short length of life that we have. And the five reflections are bringing into our awareness the fact that I am subject to aging. I have not gone beyond aging. Right? This body is subject to illness. I have not gone beyond illness. I'm subject to death. I've not gone beyond death. I will grow separate and apart from everything that is dear to me. And the fifth is the hopefulness, is that I am the owner of my actions and the heir of my actions. I'm supported through my actions. And whatever I do, I'm supported through. Life inevitably contains these painful experiences: aging, disease, death, loss, separation. Right? It also contains more situational pains, like the Buddha even says this in one of the discourses, not getting what one wants or getting what you don't want. A breakup, getting fired. Right? I always joke about 440 never being complete, right? Even the simple things. So we have these inevitables, sometimes I call them the inarguables, birth, aging, sickness, death, separation. And then we have these situationals. And life, it's in life's nature to provide those things. That's nature. It's how we show up for these experiences that really determines the degree of our suffering in life. Right? So it's how we show up in those experiences that really determines the degree of suffering. Pain is inevitable. The suffering is what's optional. Right? So what the Buddha really discovered through meditation, through this practice of mindfulness, is it's the craving and the clinging to pleasure that causes suffering. And it's the resistance and aversion to pain that also causes suffering. This is the second arrow. Wanting things to be other than the way that they are. When touched with a feeling of pain, the person without mindfulness present will sorrow, grieve, and lament, beat his breast, and become distraught. So in this way, this person feels two pains, two arrows. Right, the Buddha's enlightenment, the story of the mythological story of the Buddha sitting down and facing his own mind, his own suffering. He comes into contact with this demonic entity called Mara. And Mara is, we could think of Mara as this being, this demon being that lives in our mind. Or we can think of it as the aspects of craving, clinging, and aversion, or sometimes in their more extreme language, is greed, hatred, and delusion that lives in our mind. The first attack on the Buddha when he decided to sit down and to face his mind, to get to know his mind, to show up for these experiences in life, right, to get to know the pain in his mind, the first line of attack is hatred. So I like to think about the Buddha as like, he makes this resolution, I'm going to sit under this fucking tree until I'm completely awake. And I don't care what happens. And then a couple hours in, his legs start hurting. His mind keeps wandering. He feels restless, agitated, painful. And this anger arises in his mind. And in the imagery, which I really like, I'm very much a visual person. It helps me connect emotionally to something. In the imagery, Mara is attacking with arrows and spears. And the Buddha, in the midst of this wave of hatred in his mind, he turns his attention directly towards it. Right? This is why he calls this dharma, this practice, in this case of mindfulness, as against the stream. Because when you have hatred in your mind, why would you want to look right at it, look it dead in the eye? But he does. He turns his attention directly towards this mental agitation, this physical pain. And in this compassionate awareness, he basically says, I see you, Mara. I see you. He notes the aversion. He notices the aversion, the hatred, the resentment, the anger, the ill will in his mind. He sees it for what it is, a mind state. The mind state is extra, right? The pain is inevitable. He's sitting there, and that's hard to do. But this extra mind state that arose in his mind is this second arrow, and he turns towards it, and he says, I see you. And that's it. That's all he does, is bring compassionate awareness. He still has to sit with the pain, but this compounded suffering disappears from his mind and goes on to its next line of attack, greed, or in this case, lust. And so Mara doesn't go away, but is disarmed, right? So we don't get rid of our mind's reactivity necessarily, but it's not armed when we bring compassionate awareness to it. And this is the subtlety of the Buddha's awakening. After his supposed enlightenment, whatever that means, this awakening experience, this transformation, he says this dharma, which just means this truth, this the way things are, the truth of the way things are is subtle and hard to see. He says it's difficult to awaken to. He also says it's not confined by thought, which means you can't intellectually really do it. What he says is that it's against the stream to actually look at your mind's reactions with compassionate awareness and to say, I see you. To see the arising of this aversion in his mind was to notice that not only was there pain, but there was this compounding suffering that he could see right through. And so he also saw some other things. He saw that these mind states that arose in his mind are impermanent. They change. So if he could step back and notice the aversion in a compassionate way and patiently bear with it, it eventually passed. If he could patiently bear with the pain would change and subside. And so he started noticing, started catching on. He's like, wait a second, everything is changing. All I have to do is compassionately bear with in this present awareness. Easier said than done. It's in our evolutionary biology to crave and cling to pleasure and to resist pain. I bring it up every time I talk about craving in here. I think I bring up the neuroscience research by a guy named Melvin Connor. Melvin Connor studies the human nervous system, and he said that the chronic internal state of the human nervous system is a vague mixture of anxiety and desire. So he said your default mode of your brain is anxiety and desire. He said best described by the phrase, I want, spoken with or without an object for the verb. So we just want. I always joke around. It's like, you ever been standing somewhere and you want something? You don't even know really what you want. It's like, I know I want something. Let me think about it. You think long enough, it doesn't take that long to find something. That's the thing about the world. It provides lots of things that we can hold on to. And he's saying the problem's not out there in the world. He's actually not saying it's a problem that you have pleasure. He's saying it's in that wanting relationship. It's in that craving and that clinging. That kind of automatic grab, my teacher Dave Smith calls it the grab and drop. That automatic grab, drop, grab, drop, grab, drop, right? That we go along chasing some type of satisfaction and some experience, some temporary experience, some temporary relationship, some temporary thing. And the problem is not that we have a relationship or a temporary thing. It's that we cling on to them. Right? We get lost in this wheel of what is called samsara, this repetitive cycle of craving. The Buddha calls it perpetual wandering. You ever just feel like you're just perpetually wandering through the same behaviors over and over and over again? I do. It's like, no, I think I won't watch another episode on Netflix. I think I'll go for a walk. It's like, oh, it's sprinkling outside. Oh, okay. You know, we just kind of get lost in this craving and clinging. So on the flip side of this, right, craving and clinging to pleasure, resisting and hating pain, right? That's also, these are on the same coin. It's both just craving and clinging. It's all the same thing. But one is craving for something to be gone. And one is craving for something to either stay or to get here. So really three options. I want something that I don't have. I want something to stay that I have. I want something to go away that I have. It's biological. So, what else is biological is this capacity for mindfulness, to actually look into our own mind and to say, what is this? To turn towards this second arrow of reactivity, of craving and clinging and resistance, and to just see that mind state as a mind state and to start to work with it, right? So that's kind of what I want to talk about tonight, is practicing compassion. In particular, I want to talk about self-compassion. We'll kind of get into it and then do a little bit of the practice. But the Buddha says that compassion is the wise response to pain. It's what he understood through this practice, that the result, the fruition of all of this mindfulness practice, is that he had more of a compassionate response to pain. Some might say a completely compassionate response to pain. Now, throughout the Buddha's life, he still experienced pain. It's right there in the discourses. As much as the later, you know, followers of the Buddha tried to call him Lord Buddha and, you know, spruce it up, which all religions do to remain competitive. So you'll still find in the suttas, the Buddha had back pain his whole life. Back pain. So bad that he would be meeting with other monks, and he would have to excuse himself to lay down because the pain was too much to bear. We don't want to get rid of that biological drive, that pain, right? What we're getting rid of is that second arrow, the suffering, you know? So compassion is the wise response to pain. The word in Pali Sanskrit is karuna. And I really love this word, karuna. I think it just sounds pretty, but it also means a quivering of the heart in response to pain. That's what it means when translated. It means a quivering of the heart in response to pain. Right? We're naturally empathetic beings. I guess it's debatable. You know, maybe some people lack human empathy. It definitely seems so. But I think that the majority, at least of us, right, are naturally empathetic beings. When we see pain and we understand it as pain, that's another part. We're going to talk about this, right? When we actually see pain and understand it as pain, we're moved by it. We feel it. We feel with it. That's the root word of the word empathy, to feel with. We feel with it. It seems to almost be our natural response. When you're in pain, the reason why the biological drive is to resist it or to push it away or to not want it is because we care about being comfortable. We wish we were free from that pain. And so I'll talk about this later, but what if caring was enough? What if instead of all of this running around to try to fix, manage, and control a lot of the pain in our life, we started to learn that we can just show up for the painful experiences with care, with this innate natural tendency that all of us have that's already within us, and it's already here. That's the amazing thing about so much of this practice I'm finding, is that it's not actually anything I have to go do, this Western delusion of self-improvement. Like there's anything fucking wrong with us to begin with, you know? And this is really like, I notice that this compassion is already here. Now the wires get crossed, right? And the impulses come up and the mindfulness gets lost and it gets all sorts of screwed up. So how do we start to get, you know, into the heart with wisdom? And that's the balancing of these two qualities, wisdom and compassion. Seeing clearly and responding wisely. Deep down, all beings desire freedom from suffering. You go to kill a spider, What happens? It scrunches up. It walks faster. It moves away. It has a sense it has a life. It wants to live. All beings, deep down, we desire freedom from suffering. It's also biological. So the Buddha's encouraging us to practice training our mind in this intention of compassion, to start to really investigate what does it mean to care for our pain? What does it mean to turn towards our pain, to understand the suffering, right? And to wish ourselves to be free from it. My guess is that all of us have had many experiences of this transformation of compassion. Being in pain, finally, I feel like it's usually the last thing that I'll do still. It's like, finally, I'll sit with it. I'll sit down with it. And I'll say, yeah, what is this about? Let's look into it. Let's be with it. Let's understand it. And then let's wish for myself to be free from it. So it's important to recognize this deep intention that we have, right? And to cultivate it. That's the word in Pali Sanskrit for meditation. There's not a word for meditation. It's a Christian word. There's the word bhavana, which means cultivation. Just like you would cultivate a field, you have to cultivate this intention that's already in you, but you gotta tend to it. You gotta put your attention on it. You got to water it. You got to go out every day and pick the weeds that grow up around it. And you got to nurture it, and it will bear fruit. It's that simple. Whatever we practice, we get better at. And it just so happens that training your mind in compassion is something you can practice. So this also isn't a dismissal of action, right? Right? Rather, it's an understanding that intention often precedes action. Before I do anything, there's often a motivation there. There's some inclination. Why am I going to do what I'm going to do? So as we train our mind to practice self-compassion in meditation practice, like we're going to do tonight, as we sit and we practice recollecting that theme of compassion, the mind remembers it, right? It gets better at it. It recollects it more frequently. It looks into it, right? The mind starts becoming interested in it. And then we start showing up for very important moments where we practice it because we've been training the mind to look for it. So the way that the Buddha taught these heart practices is to start training your mind by starting with yourself as the object of this meditation practice. Now, this may sound in conflict with the Buddha's teaching on anatta, which is not self. It's really just the messiness of language. Because in this relative world, meaning right now in this room, I'm Andrew, I'm here. I'm totally here. I have a history, right? My history comes from this memory, perception, you know. But the Buddha's teaching on not self is that, you know, this experience, this consciousness of the human mind is this constant conditioning process. So who you are is not a person, but you're a person that's always evolving, like every moment. Every moment, your sense consciousness, your eyes, your nose, your ears, your mouth, your body feeling, your perceptual memory, there are six senses in Buddhism. The five we learn in kindergarten plus the mind. You ever notice the mind has a lot of sensitivity to it? When you think a thought, it affects you. I can be sitting here and nothing. I could be in a fucking float tank and my mind is creating all these sensory experiences. Right? So who we are is we're sensitive and we're constantly being affected and impacted. And so we tend to think of ourselves as, I am this, I am that. And that tendency to kind of create this solid identity causes a lot of suffering for us. You know, you get in a breakup and you think, God, I'm so single. I'm never going to find anyone. I was talking to a friend about this the other day. And all I could tell him, I was like, dude, I know exactly what that feels like. I can't say anything to fix it for you or to help you through it necessarily. I just know what that feels like. That sense of, I am unlovable, I am not worthy, I am... Usually they don't come up that explicitly in our mind, but those are the felt feelings, right? And so that I am, we got to be really careful. But at the same time, we have to start practicing towards this, you know, person package that I am that's constantly changing, bringing compassion into this being, into this chitta, this heart, you know, this heart-mind process. So we aim the heart and mind process, the emotional mental experience towards compassion. We have to start with ourselves. So this is kind of unique in the Buddhist teaching. I think most of us would agree that oftentimes it's before we help other people, it helps to have some capacity, some resource, some internal resource to draw from to be of support to other people. You know, so we've got to start to build this resource for ourselves. This is a book by Bhikkhu Analia. Bhikkhu Analia is a German monk. He's a Buddhist scholar. He lives at Barry Center for Buddhist Studies in Massachusetts. He sleeps in a coffin at night. He's very into the Buddhist teachings. He very much has practiced these things, but he also writes a lot about these things. And this book's called Compassion and Emptiness. So if you've been coming around for a while and you're like, man, I just can't get this intersection between not self and compassion to self. This is a whole book pointing to all the discourses where the Buddha talks about self and not self. But in it, he talks about, so something more practical here, is starting to develop compassion towards ourselves. This is one of the Buddha's discourses. He says, if one is not tamed oneself and wishes to tame someone else who is untamed, that is impossible. If one is drowning oneself and wishes to rescue someone else who is drowning, that is impossible. If one has not extinguished one's own reactivity and one wishes to make someone else with unextinguished reactivity extinguish their reactivity, that is impossible. And then he goes on to say the opposite. If one has tamed oneself and wishes to tame someone else who is untamed, that is certainly possible. If one is not drowning oneself and wishes to rescue someone else who is drowning, that is certainly possible. If one has extinguished one's own reactivity and wishes to make someone else with unextinguished reactivity extinguish the reactivity, that is certainly possible. I like the drowning metaphor because I feel like it's more visual. If one is not drowning oneself and wishes to rescue someone else who is drowning, that's certainly possible. So we don't want to be drowning in our own suffering. Not just for the sake of our own well-being, but for the sake of how we can show up for others. Meditation for yourself is a generous act for the world. And you don't believe that? Ask my fucking parents. You know, this practice has changed me. And it's changed me in ways that have not only impacted me, you know, it's impacted my life. My whole decision to become a social worker was because of this practice. you know? And so we have to take care of ourselves, and to understand to do so is not a selfish act. It's a generous act. And this whole thing we come up against around not deserving our love, right? That's part of what we're working with, not deserving compassion. As if someday we're going to wake up and say, oh, yeah, I deserve it today. You know, we've got to work at it. We've got to start to chisel away at that belief. The near enemy of compassion is pity. And so this is really interesting, just kind of getting into some of the nuance here. I say that I have another quote. I don't know if I do. Let me see. The cultivation of compassion itself, this is Anālio commenting now, not the Buddha. The cultivation of compassion itself finds its expression in the wish for the other or ourselves to be free from suffering. In this way, the mind takes the vision of freedom from suffering as its object. Such an object can generate a positive and at times even a joyful state of mind instead of resulting in sadness. It is vital insofar as the meditative cultivation of compassion. It is vital insofar as the meditative cultivation of compassion can only lead to deeper concentration and deeper cultivation if it is undertaken with a positive or even a joyful mind to wish ourselves or others to be free from suffering. From a practical perspective, this means that one's cultivation of compassion needs to steer clear of sadness and pity. This is not easy, since what causes the arising of compassion can naturally lead to be afflicted oneself by one's own sadness or the sadness of others. Right? So this is actually important, and it's subtle, but it's important that compassion, from a Buddhist perspective, is a wish for ourselves and for others to be free from suffering. It's not getting hung up in colluding with the sadness and the suffering. And what do I mean by colluding? The sadness and the suffering has a lot to say. You know what I mean? And you know when you're like listening to someone and that you know they're just in it. They're just kind of, they're speaking their emotion. Right? Like, you may know that what they're saying is not what they mean, you know? What they're saying is how they feel. So when we're with someone else, sometimes we can know that. And it's like, oh, I can be with you in your feeling. I see what you're saying. I see the pity. I see the victimization. I see the blaming. I see the sadness, the sorrow and the lamentation, as the Buddha says. I see that. And we're not colluding with that in this form of pity. That's not what compassion is. It's saying, I see you, I understand you, I feel you, and I care for you, and I wish for you to be free from suffering. Does that kind of feel different? I see you, I understand you, I feel with you, and I wish for you to be free from suffering. So the point Anālio is making here is we have to keep our minds steadily focused on that wish. I wish for you to be free from suffering. Here's the hard part. This is balanced with wisdom. And I understand that I can only be responsible for the ways that I suffer. I cannot do the work for you. Right? So there's two things we got to be careful for. One is pity, and one is also this kind of codependent fixing. And so that's some tough shit, right? So I'm just saying, like, as we start to explore compassion, we start to explore the edges of when we get caught up in colluding with that. You know, when we get caught up in the story of our sadness, right? Or the pity, which is the blame, victimization, that type of thing. Or when we start to get caught up in this, like, I can do the work for someone else. So the compassion for others. I can support other people. I can show up in meaningful ways, but I can't actually do it for you. So the four stages of compassionate action, these aren't real things. I made this up. And the only reason why I made this up is because sometimes I find maps or stages helpful to understand a process. So the practice we're going to do is a lot simpler than this. But the four stages, I have them up on the board: awareness, investigation, empathy, compassion. So this is kind of how we move towards compassion. Like Ajahn Chah says in his quote, if we don't know suffering, then we can't know the cause of suffering. So the first step in practicing compassion is turning towards the areas in our life, if we're talking about self-compassion, where we suffer, to start to be interested in looking at them. Now, this is very against the stream. To turn towards our suffering means that we're curious and looking at what are the ways, what are the areas, what are the experiences that you've had in your life recently where you have had a hard time. What's been difficult? What relationships have been difficult? What conversations have you had recently that were hard? What conflicts have you been involved in? You know, what emotional pain have you felt? Hurt, loss? You know, even some of the more inarguable type of pain, like even being interested in that, like a grief or, you know, loss. So I call this the looking at or looking into, or sorry, looking at and then investigations looking into. So it naturally leads into this next part, which is what's the root of this suffering, right? What's my relationship to this experience of difficulty? Where is their craving and clinging? That's to kind of get more to the point. So what are we investigating? We're looking at the reactivity around the pain. So the first step is, yeah, recognize I'm in pain. What's that? Where is that in my life? And then to look into it. What is my relationship to the pain? Does that make sense? So that's kind of that part. What's my relationship to it? Empathy is making space. Right? This is feeling into the pain, the heartache, the loss, the first arrow. Right? So I went through a breakup, right? Just as an example. Go through a breakup. There's, first of all, the acknowledgement that I just went through a breakup. Like, I know that. So let's sit down and look into it. Right? What's my relationship to that? It hurts. It hurts. I feel a loss. I feel a loneliness, a big loneliness. So then the third step already is here. Make space for the loneliness. Because when we fight it, or when we let the loneliness tell us stories, or we fight it, that's the fucking suffering. You know what I mean? So what if I could just be with just the loneliness? It's crazy because it's literally the last thing I ever want to do. And what does loneliness want? It wants to be with someone. And the last thing I'm willing to do is be with my loneliness. So, okay, I went through a breakup. Looking into it, where's my reactivity? Where are the stories? You know, where's my, distraction strategies, my avoidance, my coping, you know, that's not maybe going to serve me in the long run, but feels good now. How does that feel, right? And then underneath all of that, it's like that stuff's just garbage that's collected on top. It's not your fault, it's just there. But underneath all of that, right, is the heart in its pain. And so we make space for that, and then we nurture ourselves with love. Now, this may sound like a big step. Nurture ourselves with love. What do you need, loneliness? I'm here for you now. I made space for you. What do you need? I care about you. I love you. I'm here for you. Compassion. I wish for you to be free from this suffering. I understand that you're not. I understand that you're in pain, and I wish for you to be free from this suffering. And may you do what needs to be done to free yourself from suffering. Sometimes it's that too. It's like you can do it. Sometimes it needs encouragement. You can do it. You've been through a breakup before. You know it will move forward in its own messy way. And you'll experience more dukkha, you know, more suffering and stress. You know, so that's not supposed to be more, but it's actually encouraging. It's like, yeah, there will be more of this, and you're going to get through it again. So you got this. And it's terrible, and it's hard, and let's not make it worse. Let's look into it. Let's make space for it, and let's nurture ourselves with love instead of all of this, these stories, right? Instead of all of these behaviors, instead of all of these things. I like to put these in phrases. I see you, I understand you, I feel you, I care for you. That's kind of a mantra that I do. I've really practiced that over time. I see you, I understand you, I feel you, I care for you. Sometimes I make it even simpler, and it doesn't really follow the four stages. I just put it into three. I feel you, I know you, I care about you. I just talk straight to my heart. You know, I feel you, I know you, I care about you. So, you know, just remember that that is a practice, but that opportunity is always available to us. You know, so like when we're in pain, like, I feel you, I know you, I care about you. Or I see you, I understand. I feel you, I care for you. The road to compassion. So part of this is learning how to sit with our pain. And this isn't just emotional. Like, part of this is physical. I don't want to get too much into that because they feel like different kind of talks. You know, but you'll actually find sitting in meditation, if you go on a meditation retreat, you don't just sit for one 25-minute or 30-minute period of time. You're going to do a 30-minute, then a 30-minute walk, and then a 30-minute sit, 30-minute walk. Some meditation retreats, an hour sit, an hour walk, an hour sit, hour walk. And in that process, you come up against a lot of physical pain. And you can work with it. You can really work with it with the same practice of compassion and awareness. And it's not so much different, but it's, you know, it's kind of a, it's talking about the physical, whereas the emotional often spins a lot more stories than the physical. Yeah. So I'll just stay with the emotional. So as we show up for our emotional pain in life, part of this is learning some distress tolerance. Is like, this practice is not going to be a, like, manifest some, you know, butterflies in your life kind of thing. You know, it's not about avoidance, you know. It's about being with what is. And sometimes with what is butterflies and beautiful aspects of life, you know. And can we appreciate and delight in without attachment, right? And sometimes it's about the emotional pain and difficulty of our life, so we got to be with that. And so some of that is just about tolerance. And tolerance means basically, I'll be with this. I'm willing to be with this. And it's a practice, right? So I'm be with it as much as I can be with it, and then I may have to back off of it, right? I may like have to call a friend or distract myself with the podcast or whatever it may be, you know, use some way to back off. But, you know, how can I be with this? Can I start to sit with this a little bit, right? That's tolerance. My first practice around compassion was, can I learn to hate my pain a little bit less? It wasn't even, can I love myself? I was literally like, I'm not even on board for that one. I was like, I don't know what love is. I don't believe it's possible. I think that's a bunch of hippie weird shit. But can I hate myself less? Can I hate my pain less? I was like, yeah, I can probably do that, actually. I can probably hate that less. So that's kind of like tolerance. And then mercy is this kind of second This is kind of like tracking, and I heard a teacher say this early on in practice, and it really resonated. It's like tracking the road to compassion. Mercy, it means when you have the agency to make something worse and you choose not to. That's what being merciful is. It's like I could destroy you, Andrew, in your pain. I could just sit here and annihilate you. But I'm not going to do that. You know, I'm not going to make this worse for myself. That's another way. That's a more subtle way of saying it. So not only am I willing to be with it, but I'm not going to actually participate in the behaviors and the things that are going to make it worse. You see what I'm saying? So it's like we can kind of see. It's like I can be with this, but I'm kind of not with it, and then I'm making it worse. Right? I can be with it, but I'm not with it. I'm making it worse. And then we step into mercy where it's like I can kind of be with it, and I'm just not going to do those things that make it worse. That's it. I'm not even going to care or love or anything, but I'm just going to try to practice that. And then compassion, you know, loving ourselves through it, nurturing ourselves through it. As we practice for ourselves, right, as we practice self-compassion, we have more of an ability to show up for others. And I find that it creates an environment. Sometimes people get weirded out by the concept of karma, and I think it's because mostly this misunderstanding that there's this like kind of like metaphysical like merit bank of all of your good deeds, and they just like are paying out at different times through your life. You know, it's like you got in the car wreck. It's like that's because you cheated on your test in seventh grade, or you know, like. And that's kind of like, you know, the big God in the sky kind of childish, you know, understanding of karma. But really karma is this understanding that everything is conditional. Everything. In terms of our material world and how we relate to our material world. Everything is, you know, these momentary experiences of being affected, being impacted, relating to the impact of the experience. And so as we practice compassion, we practice conditioning our mind. And the interesting thing is they call nirvana the unconditioned. So you're conditioning, not to get so weird on this, but I'm going there, so whatever, to actually find a place that's unconditioned. You know when we say like unconditional love? That means that there's this deep abiding love within us that we just have to go in and dig out and find. And so as you're practicing, you're like digging it out and you're finding it and you're digging it out and you're finding it. And then it's like keeps showing up more, like that channel in us is just like more available. You know, the heart's true desire to care for pain. It's just more present. It's more wise. You know, like the wires are less crossed. It's more clean compassion. And then we start impacting others in our compassion, and we start feeling more compassion. We're in an environment of it, you know, because then we're around people that are interested in doing the same thing, and it's like, you know, so we create our environment in a way, and in a way we don't, so it can be sketchy. I am not saying that you living in this capitalist, patriarchal, mostly male dominated, like imperialist country and all of its shit is your fault, right? Or, you know, that poverty is people, that's a whole different thing. I'm saying our mental, emotional environment, right? And then the affect it has on people. So this is another type of compassion the Buddha calls anukampa in Pali Sanskrit, which is literally, when translated, means crying out at the crying of another. So karuna means the movement of your heart in response to pain, and anukampa means crying out at the crying of another.